this week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Little by little, they're chiseling away at our rights, our civil rights, and we have to stop it. We just really have to stop it.
As the Los Angeles racist scandal continues, we look at the story behind the scandal with Los Angeles labor and community activists.
Florida is the worst that it's been since Jim Crow. And that's what we're seeing is under capitalism, our rights can always be taken away.
Florida is facing a fight for democracy and against increasing repression and right-wing attacks.
This is who the South African longshore and transport workers are dealing with. These companies, these billionaires, they have the same mentality as the slave owners had back in the 1800s.
We'll hear about the South African National Dockers strike and the history of the shipping companies.
Mumia Abdul-Jamal has chosen to live, and we have to support this brother and help this brother come home. This brother has been gone for 40 years.
And we go to a rally for journalist, writer, and imprisoned political activist Mumia Abdul-Jamal. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. A continuing scandal over racism, redistricting, and gentrification is taking place in Los Angeles. Pacifica reporter Steve Zeltzer looked at the story behind the scandal and the connection to the redistricting, manipulation, and corruption in San Francisco with Los Angeles labor and community activist Cliff Smith, business manager of LA Roofers Local 36, who is also on the Los Angeles Federation of Labor, Dr. Nadine Diaz, a community activist in Boyle Heights, and an adjunct professor at California State University at Dominguez Hills, and Cheryl Thornton, SEIU 1021 Community Healthcare Vice President in San Francisco.
One of the things that we're talking about, particularly in San Francisco and Los Angeles, these are some of the richest cities in the world. We're talking about in San Francisco, over 80 billionaires. And in Los Angeles, a large amount of wealth. It seems like the politicians that have been elected aren't interested in going after the billionaires in Los Angeles. Is that the case, Cliff?
You know, the developers have their way. They finance the politicians, even the Democratic Party politicians, which dominate these cities. And there's no check or balance. There's no leverage. And, you know, that's what brings us back to these tapes, to these people, whether it's the labor hierarchy or the elected officials from the Democratic Party, they were in their comfort zone with those comments because they know that they're essentially untouchable. And, you know, as community activists, as labor leaders, it's our responsibility to figure out how to organize ourselves into independent coalitions and united front and not just protest and complain, essentially, but to actually fight these people for power, to win control of these positions and turn these resources, you know, toward the benefit of the community.
And is that going to happen in the labor movement? Because in your case, Cliff, and in the case of San Francisco with the SEIU 1021 members, we're fighting for fair redistricting against the gentrification. It seems like the politicians are able to continue to get elected, despite the fact that more and more people are getting angry about what's happening to them.
Well, the labor leadership in Los Angeles historically is one and the same with the Democratic Party leadership. The former head of the LA County Labor Federation, Rusty Hicks, is now the president of the state Democratic Party. The chief of staff of his successor, Ron Herrera, who was just forced out as the head of the County Labor Federation, his chief of staff, Justin Wesson, is the son of Herb Wesson, the former city council president. Justin Wesson's wife is the chief of staff of the former city council president, Nuri Martinez, who was just driven out as part of this scandal. So the interrelationships between the labor leadership and the Democratic Party are so blurry that you can't even distinguish between these people. And in fact, some of them just rotate from, you know, one position to the next. So we need to build independent community and working class coalitions to take these positions away from these people within labor and within city government.
My name is Cheryl Thornton. I'm a SEIU 10-to-1 member. I'm the vice president of our community health chapter. And I did a lot of organizing in San Francisco around the redistricting. So this redistricting process, for starters, it was used. There's been a lot of building going on in San Francisco, but it's been in a southeastern section of San Francisco, District 6 and District 10. And they, you know, have to evenly spread out the population. But on the west side of town, where District 1, 2, 3, 4, the wealthier people live, they don't really like their lines being moved too much, because basically there's resources in your neighborhood that you are accustomed to, or it may be that you lived in District 1, and if you go to District 2, your property may not be thought of as lucrative. With this redistricting, the planning department knew all this building was going on and was going to go on. They had approved it. And so to let these districts get so far out of alignment and to use that as the reason, it's not. It's just really taking resources away from Black and Brown people, doing voter suppression, redistricting where the school lines are in San Francisco, redistricting where you could go for healthcare. It's all those things involved. And so that's what happened. And through that process, as Brenda mentioned, District 6, the reason that they redrew the lines in District 6 is because in District 5, there had been so much gentrification going on. But this whole thing was really about, like I said, like Brenda mentioned, voter blocks and where people could vote and who was going to be empowered. It was the same thing that happened in Los Angeles, even though we didn't have a leaked tape of that sort. It's the same thing. And so what we learned from redistricting is what we need is better policies, more stringent policies around redistricting, because our mayor, London Breed, was, you know, pretty much the rules were wide open. And so this is what led to that. And so we need to advocate and create resolutions and legislation around redistricting so that it can be fair. So it doesn't take resources from the Black and Brown community like it's doing now. So it doesn't continue to push people out, because that was the other thing. When they redraw the lines, somehow some districts get much more wealthy and other districts become even more poor. So that we really need to create, at least in California, some type of laws that don't allow politicians to run roughshod and just, you know, do whatever they want. And then the people are just left at the will of these politicians.
Dr. Diaz?
I concur with Cliff. I mean, this has been ongoing for a long time with the LA County Democratic Party, the California State Democratic Party. Corporations dictate who will be elected, and it's a circus. I was a delegate from 2001 to 2016. And prior to that, I was a grassroots community organizer, I mean, tackling a lot of the land use issues. And I look at this from a land use lens. Everything pertains to land and what is happening in our communities as it relates to land and what is being built and what is not being built and where are people living. And this house that I live in is my late grandfather's home, and his home and my neighbors and the entire block were subject to eminent domain by the MTA, Metropolitan Transportation Authority, and the Community Redevelopment back in 1990. I had just finished undergrad, got my cultural anthropology degree, was organizing garment workers in sweatshops, which was great experience because I saw another layer of slavery, if you will, going on. Slavery, in my opinion, hasn't ended. But back to what has been happening, there was no notification, no nothing in terms of we're going to take your grandfather's land. Basically, in our community, there are limitations in terms of education, language barriers. People were being actually told you have to leave. And it's very political. It's humongous. The MTA board consists of politicians, who basically make the rules and draw the lines. And the Community Redevelopment Agency, which impacted the entire state of California, was used together to basically take land away from people. I believe that former Governor Brown got rid of the CRA, but this was 1990. And again, in our communities, it's a working class community. People have three or four jobs. People are struggling to pay rent, pay their housing mortgages, put food on the table. And all of a sudden, these huge corporations come in and tell you, you got to leave. I had to organize. I got really frustrated. I started seeing how things work. Our councilman at the time was former councilman Rich Valatore, who was another person who was inept. And basically, he was just like, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing that you can do. You just need to mind your own business and stay out of it. And that just empowered me even more to knock on every single door in the community and say, what's going on? And this is what's happening. And again, a good percentage don't know how to navigate through the system. They'll put their head down and just move out or be treated inhumanely. And I'm not that way. And I started pushing the envelope and was called by the Democratic Party. We want you to be a delegate. So in other words, just to basically muzzle me, if you shake the cage, if you question the intentions of these politicians that are bought and paid for by corporations that put them in office and decide our destiny, they will character assassinate you. I was threatened. I got phone calls. You better stop what you're doing or else we're going to kill you. Why do you have to film everything? I had boxes. I carried a camera wherever I went. And the politicians would ask me, why do you do this? I said, because you are liars. You lie to the public. You lie and you're destroying our community. So go ahead and shoot me. Shoot me to shut me up. But when I got involved as a delegate, I started to see the layers of corruption even in front of me. It's not just Boyle Heights, East LA, South LA. It's all over the country that this is going on. And people like us with good intentions who really give a damn can see through the smoke screens. We often get pushed back, but we can't. We have to stand up and organize and mobilize and strategize a coalition at the state and national level. The redistricting is just, I call it planned by design. It's planned by design to try to kill us, basically, and to kill our families and our children and our seniors. We have food deserts where I live. We don't have quality food. We don't have quality education. Charter schools are another ball of wax that are built by corruption from these politicians. I think another thing we really need to look at is legislation. They use politicians to create legislation in terms of land use. For example, Assemblyman Miguel Santiago just created legislation which prevents us to give input about what happens in our community and also prevents any kind of EIR reports. So little by little, they're chiseling away at our rights, our civil rights, and we have to stop it. We just really have to stop it.
Those were labor and community activists in Los Angeles discussing the City Council and LA Federation officials' secret meetings to manipulate district elections and the San Francisco connection with Pacifica's Steve Zelter. Florida remains a key battleground state in the war waged against our democratic rights by the far right. With DeSantis eyeing a presidential run in the near future, longtime community activist and radio host Ruth Beltran and co-host Ali Abdel Kada, along with St. Petersburg's tenants union organizer Carla Correa, analyzed the DeSantis administration's racist, sexist, and anti-gay policies and their implications for the rest of the nation. Here is the clip from The Ruthless Truth on WSLR, Pacifica affiliate in Sarasota, Florida, looking at the issue of voting and other assaults on our democratic rights.
You are listening to The Ruthless Truth. Let's talk about democracy in Florida. What are your thoughts on democracy, and do we live in a real democracy?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is kind of a theme throughout DeSantis' time in office. Everything he's done is to minimize the voice of the people, to minimize people's participation. You know, we saw right off the bat, right after the mass uprising in 2020 against racism and police brutality, HB 1, anyone remembers the anti-protesting bill, it was called. He was trying to make it a felony for people to even donate to protests. That's collective punishment. He was trying to make it legal to run over protests, trying to intimidate and silence those advocating for racial justice and attack on Black and brown people advocating for justice. And when you make someone a felon, it can take away their ability to get food stamps, to get any assistance, to vote. And we just saw that with voter intimidation tactic he just used, where he got 20, I think it was, people arrested for voting, saying that they didn't pay all their fines and fees. So it's like, we're seeing people getting arrested for voting. Florida is the worst that it's been since Jim Crow. Like, we're getting worse. We're going backwards. And that's what we're seeing is, under capitalism, our rights can always be taken away.
That's right. How can we truthfully say that we're living in a democracy here in the U.S. and here in Florida when our politicians just have the power to override the will of the people and to suppress people, to keep them from being able to vote? This attack on the voting rights of felons who are legally allowed to vote in Florida because of the constitutional amendment that was put forth in 2020, but are being held back by a reactionary government. This is not just because they dislike felons. This is a wide battle with real historical context. It's to keep working class people from being able to exercise democratic control over our government. Let's think about it today. DeSantis and the Republican Party at large know that they cannot win elections outright if they run on their ultra far right reactionary agenda. If they ran on their actual policies, they want to see schools privatized, they want to see Medicare and Social Security rolled back. They can't actually win elections off of that fair and square. They have to use voter intimidation tactics, because they know if the voting process was fair at all, they would not win. DeSantis would not win. Republicans would not win. And actually, right here, I want to plug an amazing article that I just read, because this is something that I had not known a lot about. It's the legacy of Reconstruction in America. And the article that I read was called The Third Reconstruction by Eugene Perrier. You can check it out on Liberation School. But throughout Reconstruction, after so many formerly enslaved people became free and had voting rights, there was a real reactionary pushback to try and stop Black people from being able to participate in democracy, from being able to vote in the South, because they did not want working class interests to be able to enter government, to be able to maybe enact things like land reform that would hurt the interests of the ultra wealthy.
As the working class, it can all be taken away at any point. You know, when it comes to abortion, that's exactly what we see happening here. And DeSantis and the Florida legislation have been fighting for a very long time to repeal and roll back reproductive rights that were protected by the Supreme Court before.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see that Florida is kind of being used as a testing ground state, kind of like Texas with abortion. But now we're seeing, like, with the Don't Say Gay bill that DeSantis enacted, which is basically saying that in schools, you can't talk about sexual orientation at all. We're seeing that even more extreme version of that is being introduced in Congress. So what happens in Florida impacts the whole country. Well, of course, what happens in the South impacts the whole country. So here in Florida, we need to be mobilizing against DeSantis and against these fascist policies.
And I think it's really important to say that even politicians like DeSantis, they know how unpopular their stance on abortion is. Monday night, when there was the debate of DeSantis versus Crist, he wouldn't even answer when he was asked if he was going to outright ban abortion. And the reason he wouldn't answer is because he knows how unpopular it is. This is a national battle against abortion rights, against democratic rights, against reproductive rights, against all of these rights that we've won through struggle. And Florida is a key battleground state state in that struggle. DeSantis and the local Republicans here have been fighting to repeal and roll back our rights even before the Supreme Court opened the door with the decision earlier this summer. So it's just like you said, Carla, we have to recognize the importance of our state, and we have to recognize the political moment that we're in with the large attack on our democratic rights.
Definitely. And it's important to point out the role that DeSantis has played and the different actions that he have taken in the last 2 years that speak for themselves regarding the type of governor that he is. A governor that's very attached to the business community. He has benefited from the business community and he works very closely with the business community while ignoring the suffering and the needs of the actual working class. And this is something that was so very prevalent when it came to COVID. And I don't know if we are all aware of the final number, but over 82,000 people died from COVID in the state of Florida. And the New York Times reported this week that 38 people continue to die from COVID in Florida on a daily basis. 38 is our daily average of people that continue to die from COVID. And as we know, DeSantis was the governor throughout the entire COVID pandemic. And every excess death can be contributed to his government and to the horrific positions that he took when he came to vaccine dissemination and even treatment dissemination. We saw how biased it was, how nonchalant we were as people were dying. 82,000 people dying in one state alone is completely unacceptable.
You just heard from Ruth Beltran, Ali Abdel-Kader, and Carla Correa on The Ruthless Truth from WSLR Pacifica affiliate in Sarasota, Florida.
In there, vote them out. That's what election day is all about. The biggest gun we've got is called the ballot box. So if you don't like who's in there, vote them out. Vote them out.
Vote them out.
Vote them out.
Vote them out.
And when they're gone, we'll sing and dance and shout. They bring some new ones in. We'll start that show again. And if you don't like who's in there, vote them out.
That was a classic by Willie Nelson, Vote Them Out. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Makua Holt. A strike of South African dockers continues, and J.V. Dube, the General Secretary of the Revolutionary Transportation Union of South Africa, and ILWU Local 10 immediate past president Trent Willis talk about the strike and the history of the shipping companies.
My name is Joseph Vela Dube. I'm general secretary of the TUSA, which is the Transport Workers of South Africa. We are organizing in transport, in warehouses, in stevedores, and in all transport related actually sectors in South Africa. We are one of the most revolutionary and socialist trade union in South Africa, which is dealing with a lot of issues. Comrade, we've been involved in the past few weeks, in fact, 3 weeks, with regard to the strike, as you've been just following in South Africa in regard to the strike that was taking place in Transnet. Transnet is a logistic company in South Africa, which is a parastatal, a state-owned company, which is responsible for transporting of coal, transporting of goods, import and export. And it's responsible for almost next to 60 to 70% of transportation of goods in South Africa. It's a very big company in South Africa, Transnet. We've started wage negotiations around July this year. And it was a very intense kind of wage negotiation. Around August, we then reached into a deadlock with the company Transnet. There were almost three unions that are involved, which is UNTO, United Transport Workers of South Africa, SA Transport Workers, which is SADAW, NUMSA, which is National Union Metal Workers of South Africa, and RETUSA, which is Revolutionary Transport Workers of South Africa. Transnet, I think around on the 25th of August, we reached a deadlock with Transnet. Transnet at first was offering 0%. You can imagine currently in South Africa, the inflation is around 7.8%. And Transnet was offering just 0%. On the first meeting after, you know, this certificate which was issued on the 25th of August, 2022, the company then issued the offer of 1.5%. We as trade union, we just call that as crazy, as insult, you know, to the whole workers. Transnet is having employing around 55,000 workers in South Africa, 55,000. So it's a huge company. We then said to Transnet, you know, there's no way that workers will accept, you know, the 1.5%. Then the strike commenced probably around the 6th of October. When the strike, it was seen that it was having a huge impact. There was no movement with the trains in South Africa moving from Emelo, which is in Mpumalanga region, transport calls, which is 200 trucks on each and every hour. You can then imagine the day, the impact that is caused, that is in terms of exportation.
Hi, my name is Trent Willis. I'm the immediate past president of the International Longshore Warehouse Union, Local 10. The ILWU has been a beacon of light for working people since the 1930s, and in particular for the most exploited people when it comes to labor, the Black and Brown people, you know, all over the world. The struggle continues. The ILWU, along with our South African brothers and sisters, are involved in a struggle right now. Even though we're not on strike as of right now, but we are in a battle to maintain what we have fought for the past 88 years, and to also be compensated and treated in a respectful way by our employers. That struggle continues, and it's just my generation's turn to make sure that we are successful in those struggles. As you may have seen through social media and news outlets, the ocean carriers, shippers, and terminal operators have made record profits since the pandemic and during the pandemic. Billions and billions of dollars in profits. The inflation is at an all-time high. Okay, gas prices are out of this world. Everything is more expensive. It's more dangerous to interact in society. It's gotten to the point where the rich have become just astronomically richer, and the poor have become astronomically poorer. Okay, all of the evidence is in the streets. Working people all have something in common. The same employers. Okay, they might be under a different name or a different umbrella in South Africa, but they're the same employers, the same shippers. They've been in business for many, many years, hundreds of years. Matter of fact, my people, African Americans, were once the cargo of these same shippers. It was kind of ironic, but I was watching an old movie, Huckleberry Finn. And there was a scene in Huckleberry Finn where they were unloading a slave ship. And on the side of the slave ship, it said P&O shipping. And I literally had worked a P&O ship like 3 days before I saw that, or I noticed that in that movie, which was very eye-opening to me, that I am now working ships that used to, well, not the same ships, but the, you know, the same companies that used to ship slaves. So this is who we're dealing with. This is who the South African longshore and transport workers are dealing with. These companies, these billionaires, they have the same mentality as the slave owners had back in the 1800s, They are the same people who have been blocking Reconstruction since the 1870s. They are the same people who, every time society moves in a progressive way towards uniting the races, towards uniting working people, these are the people who are standing in the way. And they're using a lot of different tactics to pretty much divide workers. And when you can divide workers, you can control workers. When you can control workers, you can control resources. And when you control resources, you have worldwide dominance. And all of these billionaires are striving for worldwide dominance to control resources in a world that is becoming more populated every day. So we have to realize the situation we're in and form our fight back around that.
That was J.V. Dube, General Secretary of the Revolutionary Transportation Workers of South Africa, and ILWU Local 10 immediate past president, Trent Willis, talking about the South African National Dockers strike and the history of the shipping companies.
Nkosi sikelele Africa, maluphakanyisa uthumbo layo, izwa imithandazo yethu. Nkosi sikelela thina lusapho lwayo. Nkosi sikelela Afrika, maluphakanyisa uthumbo layo, izwa imithandazo yethu. Nkosi sikelela thina lusapho lwayo.
Nkosi Sikelela Africa by Till Records Choir. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Our reporter in Washington, D.C., Thomas O'Rourke, filed this report concerning the ongoing Pittsburgh Post-Gazette strike when it reached D.C. last week.
150 workers for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, one of the oldest continuously published newspapers in the country, continued an unfair labor practice strike against owner Block Communications after it unilaterally canceled health insurance for production, distribution, and advertising workers and walked away from the bargaining table. Last week, those striking members of Teamster and Communication Workers of America locals were joined by members of the Newspaper Guild, also demanding restoration of benefits and a return to the bargaining table to hammer out a new contract. Negotiations began in 2017, and after 3+ years of bad faith bargaining by management lawyers, according to the Guild, the owner twin brothers John and Alan Block unilaterally declared an impasse and imposed pay and benefit cuts and other onerous conditions on its workers. A picket of one consisting of the PPG Washington Bureau Chief Ashley Murray was joined by some 50 union officials and supporters in a protest on the U.S. Capitol grounds last Tuesday. This reporter had a chance to speak to her about this strike action.
We are on an unfair labor practice strike, and what we are asking for the company to come to the bargaining table. We want the bargaining impasse to be lifted, and we want our 2017 contract to be restored. There are other units that are out on strike as well. They went out about 10 days before us. We want them to get their health care back. And then we just want everyone to return to the table. We want this strike to end. So I would encourage any listeners, if they want to take some action, to reach out to Block Communications and tell them to negotiate with their workers. I am with the newspaper guild of Pittsburgh.
Newspaper guild. And the other units out on strike before you?
They are people who make up our designers, fleet, our printers, so the production staff.
About how many people in those units all together?
All together, roughly 60.
60. And the newspaper guild folks, how many are?
There are.
So altogether 160.
Not all on strike.
No, they're not. So what are the main issues that you're out on strike for?
We want our bargaining impasse to end. Bargaining impasse to end. We want our contract from 2017 to be restored. And we want
Did it expire?
The contract expired, and then the company declared an illegal impasse.
Okay, that's your position, that they declared an impasse and you were still bargaining in good faith and they were not. Tell me the company again.
Block Communication.
Tell me about the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
The Pittsburgh Post-Gazette is like a pillar in the Pittsburgh community. This is where people from not only Allegheny County but the surrounding counties get their news. And what is so disturbing about the strike is that we need to be reporting on these important upcoming midterm elections. I'm here covering our lawmakers, you know, normally, under normal circumstances, and this is a threat to democracy. And we need the owners to come back to this table, to bargain with us, and to compromise on a deal, and get everybody back to work reporting on the news that the readers of Western Pennsylvania want. And have supported for a long time, but you know, they're really souring now that they see that the workers are, you know, being treated like this.
I understand the police shut you down when you started to speak. Is that correct?
No, I was not. They did not shut me down when I started to speak. They did talk to some of the other organizers here. Because normally I would be filing stories from the halls of Congress. I'd be in there under normal circumstances. I mean, a lot of people are out campaigning now, but I would be in there reporting, and this is where I work. Be outside and show that I would rather be back to work and I want the blocks to negotiate.
For updates on the strike, as well as a way to donate to the strike fund, go to unionprogress.com or pghguild.com.
That was a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette striker talking to WPFW's Thomas O'Rourke in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
Symbols of democracy are pinned against the coast. Outhouse of bureaucracy surrounded by a moat. Citizens of poverty are barely out of sight. The overlords escape near evening, the brothers on the night. Morning come and bring the tourists straining rubber necks. Perhaps a glimpse of the cowboy making the world a new respect. It's a massive irony for all the world to see. It's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C. It's the nation's capital, it's the nation's capital. It's the nation's capital, it's Washington, D.C.
That was the legendary Gil Scott-Heron, Washington, D.C. On October 26, rallies were held in Philadelphia and Oakland to call for a new hearing in the case of CWA-NABT journalist, writer, and imprisoned political activist Mumia Abu-Jamal. In Oakland at the Federal Building, Jack Heyman of the Labor Committee to Free Mumia Abu-Jamal, as well as ILWU Local 10 member David Newton, the nephew of Huey P. Newton, spoke about why Mumia should be freed.
What he documented was Mumia is innocent and he's been framed up since day one. He's America's most well-known political prisoner. And we formed the Labor Action Committee to free Mumia Abu-Jamal because we understand that there is no justice in this racist capitalist justice system. And it's going to take the working class in motion, mobilized, to free Mumia. What we did 23 years ago in 1999, first the teachers in Oakland, the OEA had a one-day teach-in on the racist death penalty and on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. That set the stage for what the Longshore Union did later when we brought the question of Mumia Abu-Jamal, political prisoner, former Black Panther, supporter of MOVE, to the ILWU. And not only did the local here in San Francisco and Oakland call for shutting down the ports, but we took it to the entire union and we shut down the whole coast for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
All right.
I have the honor of introducing our next speaker from ILWU Local 10, who's carrying on this tradition of class struggle. David Newton is Huey Newton's nephew, and we call him on the waterfront Brother Newt. Come on up, Brother Newt.
My name is David L. Newton. I am a member of Local 10, hashtag Longshoreman. Yeah. Also, I'm a representative of the Young Panther Group.
Yay.
February 17, 1968, our people gathered not far from here at the Oakland Auditorium for a Free Huey rally. That was Huey's birthday, and he was unjustly charged with a murder charge against a policeman similar to comrade Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is Philadelphia. Now let's do the Philadelphia to Oakland connections. Oakland set it off. Philadelphia, they always set it off. Mumia is convicted while a mayor is in office. A former mayor was a previous police chief. I think that commissioner, I think that has to be mentioned. You're also talking about a governing body that blew up small children, women, and men in the MOVE group, dropped a bomb in the middle of the city. This is who this man is convicted under. So to say that he was unjustly convicted is not unreasonable. You have political prisoners that have been exonerated, like shout out Geronimo Pratt. Mumia has not been released from prison, but his prison death sentence has been reduced to life in prison. What a gift. Yeah. But if he was reduced to life in prison, why can't he be exonerated is my question. This man deserves a new trial. You have old former Panthers from Philadelphia, my aunt Elaine Brown, migrate to Oakland. You have my adopted uncle, David Hilliard. He couldn't even sleep in a house because the house may get raided. They had to keep garbage bags and run out the back door. The only time he could go to sleep was on a plane. He would charter a plane from Oakland to New York and back just to get a night's sleep. So this is the environment that Mumia is living in. You have to know that. So lastly, one of the most controversial statements of today's time is Brother Kanye West, the world's most hated. He said that slavery was a choice. What a sickening statement, but he's not all the way wrong. What he left out is you either live or you die. Yeah. I'm a descendant of the slave that chose to live. Dr. Huey P. Newton, my uncle, my father's name is Melvin, chose to live. We are descendants of them. I think it has to be mentioned, Dr. Martin Luther King is an honorary longshoreman. He's a descendant of a slave. They chose to live. So you have to bring all of that in full fold. If I chose to die, do I kill my wife? Do I kill my children? Do I kill myself? So these are the choices that are made. Mumia Abu-Jamal has chosen to live, and we have to support this brother and help this brother come home. This brother has been gone for 40 years. This is ridiculous. So what more can we say? We're out here because we love Mumia, we love the people. All power is in the people, and we have to end this with the 10-point program started. Number one, we want freedom. Number 10, we want justice and peace for all of our people. All power to the people.
Those were speakers at a rally to free Mumia Abu-Jamal at the Oakland Federal Building on October 26th.
Homeland and hip-hop. So think about the origins of hip-hop in this culture, and also about homeland security, is to see that there are, at the very least, two worlds in America. One of the well-to-do, and another of the struggling. For if ever there was the absence of homeland security, it is seen in the gritty roots of hip-hop. For the music arises from a generation that feels, with some justice, that they have been betrayed by those who came before them, that they are, at best, tolerated in schools, appeared on the streets and almost inevitably destined for the hellholes of prison. They grew up hungry, hated, and unloved. And this is the psychic fuel that generates the anger that seems endemic in much of the music and poetry. One senses very little hope above the personal goals of wealth to climb above the pit of poverty. In the broader society, the opposite is true. For here, more than any other place on earth, wealth is so widespread and so bountiful that what passes for the middle class in America could pass for the upper class in most of the rest of the world. Their very opulence and relative wealth makes them insecure, and homeland security is a governmental phrase that is as oxymoronic, as crazy as, say, military intelligence or the U.S. Department of Justice. They're just words that have very little relationship to reality. Now, do you feel safer now? Do you think you will anytime soon? Do you think duct tape and Kleenex and color codes will make you safer? From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Immortal Technique, Homeland and Hip Hop. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. In San Francisco, there has been a collapse of the payroll system for the school district's teachers, janitors, and other service workers. The union president of SEIU 1021 for the San Francisco Unified School District, Rafael Picazo, also blamed the cutoff of healthcare benefits, resulting in the death of a member. The district has spent millions of dollars on the software program Empower, which is being used for the payroll and failing to do its job.
My name is Christian Benitez. So today we're having an action here at 555 Franklin, our district headquarters, with a different union. So that we know the teachers union is here and SEIU 1021 is here. That represents custodial staff, that represents the clerks, which are the office personnel, and also student nutrition, which is the cafeteria workers.
And why are you here?
Well, the main reason that we're here is we're having an issue with our pay, right? It's a new software that the SFUSD has implemented. They spent close to $20 million, and it's not working. You know, a lot of people are going without pay. They don't know when that's going to happen. There's over 3,000 tickets, of which each employee has put in, right? And the norm right now at SFUSD is that, you know what, the system is broken, and be happy that you get a paycheck instead of trying to resolve and fix the issue, right, with something that's not working. And that's really hard to say to people who haven't gotten paid in months. Like myself, I went on leave. I didn't get paid for that leave until almost 10 months later. Right. Also, my AFLAC was canceled, even though my payments were being taken off for my payment. When I contacted AFLAC to make a claim on the leave that I was done, they were like, well, your policy has been terminated because for the lack of payment. So the district was collecting my monies, but wasn't remitting the payments. So that's just a few of the things that are happening. Another big issue that we have is like the staffing that's happening. A lot of people are leaving. Why is that? Because they're not getting paid. And also, if you go to a different city agency within here, city and county of San Francisco, we're about 30% behind on pay. So we're asking for parity.
You have a new superintendent.
Absolutely.
What has he done about this?
So far, we've been in talks with him, but nothing really has been done. We got an email this morning that they brought in a consultation firm or something, an outsider, to try to fix this issue. But about 2 weeks ago, they paid another company, or the same company, I believe, close to $3 million to try to fix a problem. And all that's doing is nothing. The problems still continue. People are not getting paid, right? And, you know, the cost of
corruption here, you think that's part of it?
It could be, right? It could be that that's it, because, you know, why would they bring in that system when the system we had before was here for years with PeopleSoft and we never had problems, right? I'm not to say that there wasn't any problems, but not to this level that affects so many people. You're going to hear some teachers that haven't gotten paid in 7-8 months.
And this is mostly destroying lives. Absolutely. If people can't get paid?
Yeah, absolutely. Like myself, I had to get into debt. I had to take out loans, right, to be able to cover, you know, my mortgage, to be able to cover my car bills. I can't tell my creditors, hey, my job didn't pay me. Can I pay you when they pay me? It doesn't work that way. But the district seems to think that. They seem to think to tell you that, hey, we're going to try to do something and not do nothing and not resolve it is going to make us whole. That doesn't make us whole. That's why we're here today for this action, right? So that, you know, everybody can be made whole, not just our groups or our union, but for everybody in San Francisco Unified School District with the represented class and the unrepresented class, because this is affecting all of us.
My name is Mary Sarasoli. I taught at Lincoln High School last year, and I was let go at the end of the year. And I didn't get paid $37,000, over 37, and that includes my pension contributions, class coverages, and
how long have you been a teacher?
Almost 20 years, but I taught in New York and I taught in Rome, Italy. So last year was my first year here at SFUSD and my last, and I will never return to teaching after what happened with that principal. She shouldn't be a principal. It was incredibly dangerous. It's still a dangerous school.
He died because he went on medical leave, and the district, instead of putting him on a leave of absence, they ended up terminating him on Empower, which canceled his medical insurance, which made things complicated for a man who's already really sick, and the stress and him not being able to get his medicines and so forth eventually just killed him. And I grew up with this man as a young 15-year-old kid running the streets of San Francisco, going to the schools in San Francisco. And then we both end up working for the school district, him a paraeducator, me in the Environmental Health and Safety Department. And then to find out what Empower is doing to our staff and our workers, it killed me when I found out he died because of it and that it was a cause of his death.
So, I mean, basically, the idea that you don't have medical care, you don't have compensation, and you're working full-time for the school district?
He had it. He just went on medical leave because he was going through some treatments, and without getting into his illness and so forth, but, you know, he went in for some treatments, but when he couldn't get his medicine and had to go through the process of getting it all reactivated, it was too much on him, and it eventually killed him. Just added too much stress for him.
So it's actually killing people, this situation.
Is what I'm saying. It can, and it, you know, stress is hard on a lot of people, and especially if you're sick and you lose your medical insurance and you go through 2 months of trying to fix it, 3 months of trying to fix it, and when it does get fixed, it's a little too late. The medicine's not there, he's not getting the care he needed, and the stress killed him.
Some of these people said that there should be an unfair labor practice strike. You're not getting paid. I mean, it's crazy, but, you know, you're doing your job and you're not getting paid. It's supposed to be the law that you get paid.
Right.
Why are you still working?
These are a bunch of loyal, dedicated workers, not just to the San Francisco Unified School District, but to our clients, and our clients are the students. So we can't just let our students go without. So we're doing our best to serve our kids, from the teachers to the custodians to the student nutrition workers. These are people who have been dedicated to this district their whole career. And they don't want to leave the kids blind, but if push comes to shove, like it says, will strike if provoked. And I do believe a majority of all the district's workers will go on strike if provoked.
And this has happened in other school districts. Oakland, they're shutting down schools.
Yes, shutting down of schools. Now, that's devastating. Keeping schools open, having smaller class sizes is a pipe dream for the schools. So why not keep the schools open and just have smaller class sizes? And, you know, our kids get to learn a little better. Our teachers are able to teach a little bit better. They got to use some common sense and put the money into the schools and not to top-heavy management. We're one of the largest heavy managements in the school district in California.
Those were the voices of San Francisco Unified School District workers who have not been paid wages or health care benefits because of a breakdown of their software program, Empower. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Fazilyev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this in all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.